What happens when you have a profound experience that can't be explained? Do you take it as madness, as divine inspiration, or do you spend the rest of your life trying to figure it out? Today, we're sharing stories about the extraordinary visions of Philip K. Dick. Welcome to Shadowland, everybody.
Welcome.
This is a podcast that shines a spotlight on stories of the supernatural, mysterious, eerie, and unexplained. Stuff like forest mimics,
extraordinary visions,
life after death,
extraterrestrial transmissions,
multiverse theory,
parallel dimensions,
Mars anomalies,
hallucinogens,
dream telepathy,
ancient lore,
road trolls,
ancient races of aliens,
all that stuff.
All that stuff and more.
Lots more. I'm Christina Callery.
And I'm Seth Jablon.
And today we're sharing stories about
Philip K. Dick, or more specifically, the extraordinary visions of Philip K. Dick.
I'm excited for this one because I'm not super familiar with him.
Yeah, which I find surprising because I don't know. I just feel like he's kind of become part of pop culture. But maybe if you didn't know the films that were, you know, that he did the original stories for, you might not know. But yeah, so I'm eager to sort of share some of his stories with you.
Very cool. Very cool.
All right. So yeah. Well, do we just jump right in? Then?
Yeah. Let's get into it. I know it's been a while. We've taken a break. We had some stuff going on.
Yes, we've had a bit of a hiatus.
We're back in full. Yeah.
We're back.
And we've got some.
I'm recording
cool stuff
from
coming
a new location. So yeah.
That's right. Yeah. You've got exciting new digs.
Yep. So. Cool. Okay. Well, so I guess, yeah, I'll just jump right into it. But yeah, I mean, just for those who are not familiar, just a few words of introduction about Philip K. Dick. So Philip K. Dick, sometimes referred to as PKD, he was a visionary science fiction author. And I would go far as to say an icon, right? Some would place him in the context of the psychedelic experience of the latter part of the past century, but I'm sure he would not like that comparison. He wrote a prolific amount of science fiction stories, novels and otherwise, many of which went on to become seminal science fiction films, and all of which carry with them his sort of signature themes. And so some of these are Blade Runner, which was based on his book, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Total Recall, A Scanner Darkly, Paycheck, Minority Report, and the television series A Man in a High Castle, is just to name a few. So he actually wrote quite a few.
I know most of those names, but I'm honestly, they're on my list now because I've never seen any of them.
You've never seen any of them?
Embarrassed to admit, no, but I need to.
Wow. Okay. So I would go see Blade Runner, the original Blade Runner first, right? And then A Scanner Darkly. Really? You never saw Minority Report? Interesting. Well, then I would say that would be next. Paycheck's okay, but I think it's like Ben Affleck's in it. I can't remember exactly. But it's good. It's a good movie. Like, and there's more. I'm sure I'm leaving out some right now, but I know that I am. But yeah, so I would definitely check those out. But many of these works deal with alternate realities or sometimes invented realities masquerading as the truth. So some are visions of something higher, something beyond, something, you know, sometimes madness, sometimes the sublime, which reflected much of his own life, inner and otherwise, which often blur the lines between the real and unreal, the true and the imagined. So a great deal of his work grappled with his own visionary experiences, like the masterwork of VALIS, which stands for Vast Active Living Intelligent System. And a particular set of experiences really defined his worldview and largely the latter part of his life, which seemed at times a magical reality in and of itself. That set of visions that lasted a period of months is often referred to as 2374, which denotes the time periods in which they occurred, which is essentially February to March of the year 1974. He had other visions, you know, before that time and other strange experiences and after, but that was really kind of a seminal time for him in terms of these experiences. So it would be challenging, if not impossible, to capture the breadth and depth of the contents of these visionary experiences, or really offer any, like, you know, really meaningful explanation for them here. But I'll try to relay a few in particular, and then, you know, obviously give you my take on, and, you know, we can discuss on what we think might have happened. Okay, but first let me just give you an overview of, you know, the experience of his life leading up to these events. So he had a pretty crazy life, you know, complete with his own sort of personal Jungian mythology. He was very into Jung and archetypes and all that. But probably the most important event of his life, according to him, happened not long after when he was born. And that was the death of his twin sister, Jane Charlotte Dick. So Jane and Philip were twins, and they were, you know, they were both born 6 weeks early, and Jane did not last the 6 weeks. So he often thought of her, dreamt of her. I would even go far to say he was haunted by her. He experienced her loss acutely for the rest of his life. It was very
like literally haunted, do you think?
No, I don't mean like in terms of like, you know, paranormal activity, but I mean in terms of like he couldn't there was something about that experience that he couldn't let go. Mm-hmm. And it really he often referred to as the twin that wasn't there. But he basically experienced her loss acutely for the rest of his life. Oh, here it is. Yeah, he often referred to as his phantom twin. And it was her death that also caused a, you know, lifelong rift between himself and his mother, as he often felt that she believed him somehow at fault, or even that, you know, maybe she thought the wrong twin had died. So it was like a very painful part of his life, but one that he still held dear. He was, you know, pretty close to her, or at least to her memory and to her in spirit throughout his entire life. His childhood after that continued to be very rough, very tumultuous. Again, too full of strife as to sort of represent properly here. But it all went to his difficulties later in life with, he had some struggles with mental illness and, like, you know, I think a certain type of ambition and low self-esteem. He struggled with paranoia, which was made worse by the fact that he was sometimes right, like the fact that he was once visited by the CIA. And there were other things as well. Again, too many to go into here, but he was, you know, he had these sort of like extraordinary experiences. He often thought the CIA was spying on him. There were times when the CIA was spying on him. So
don't you hate that?
yeah. But drugs were definitely also a component of his life, though more so at specific times. He would have these like pretty intense periods, and then periods where he wasn't using drugs. And I think he, you know, from what I understand, he didn't appreciate the sort of characterization of himself as part of the psychedelic drug culture, and nor did he like to be defined by that. I think he didn't want his experiences to be interpreted as the sole result of such, and so sort of, you know, dismissed as mere hallucinations. And certainly they are of a scope that is hard to compare by definition. Okay. So I'm gonna start with one of the experiences from March 1974, and it was an experience when one day a woman came to his door. So Dick had just had his wisdom tooth extracted, and they had given him a great deal of sodium pentothal. He was home recovering, and he was in a great deal of pain. So his wife calls the pharmacy, and they send someone to deliver his medication. So he opens the door, and he is greeted by this young woman wearing a gold necklace with a fish on it. the sunlight struck it, and he found himself dazed by the glimmer of the light in the gold. He said he was even sort of hypnotized by it. It gleamed with this other sort of otherworldly sight, and he took it as a sign. He asked her, "What does it mean?" And she touched it with her hand and said, "This is the sign worn by the early Christians." And with that, she handed him his medicine and left. He said he then experienced a state which he later described as anamnesis, which means loss of forgetfulness. He loved all these fucking Greek words. So he remembered who he was, and suddenly it all came back to him. He not only remembered, but suddenly found himself back there with the girl. They were living in ancient Rome as secret Christians. And this whole experience lasted only a few seconds, but left a strong impression on him that lingered. Then, say a month later, it all started slowly, then quickly coming back to him. He did not believe it was an alternate reality, but that what he called transtemporal constancy. So he believed that ancient Rome did not exist solely as sort of in the past, but in a concurrent relationship to the present. So we've talked about this a little bit on the show. I don't know, the idea of certain times being connected together sort of outside of time. And he saw it as this direct relationship, that there was this period of ancient Rome that kind of sort of exists sort of in the now, you know, in a direct relationship to the present, to the present day civilization and people living here. So these visions continued on and began to invade his life. And he felt like someone was actually taking over his life. But he said it actually strangely made it for the better. He said this sort of presence actualized him and began to run his life with more sort of grit and presence and sort of presence in mind and responsibility. He said he started making more money. He called up and fired his agent and kind of started putting his life in order in a way that he hadn't really before. He again, you know, would have these experiences where, you know, he started to become sort of obsessed with this, you know, the fish symbol I'm talking about, the Christian sort of fish symbol.
Oh, yeah.
He had it on his window and he was looking at it one day, and it sort of again sort of transported him to some ancient city. He said it might have been ancient Mesopotamia. And then at other times he would have these experiences where he felt like the Romans were here now with him. So they were very strange experiences. They weren't sort of cut and dry. He felt like he had this connection with literally another person or another time. He would sort of switch places with them. He would sort of live that person's life, and that person would come here and live his life.
He used this symbol as sort of a conduit or something to kind of.
Well, I think in a couple of the cases that I'm reading about, they were the symbol sort of, there were things that would sort of spark him. And in this case, this was one of them, but it's not the only one. There was other ones. But this symbol was important to him because it was a symbol used by early Christians as sort of a secret symbol to communicate that they were Christian to each other without the Romans knowing, right? And so the person that he thought he was sort of in contact with there what was an early Christian. And so, yeah, like I said, it was not clear. He was a lot of his experiences, he would reinterpret for the rest of his life, right? And so sometimes he felt like it was actually him born again, or sometimes he felt like that person was actually sharing in his reality. He kind of saw it in a lot of different lights. Eventually, he believed that it was actually the spirit of Elijah that had come to him, and that he experienced, okay, here's another one of those words, enthusiasmos, which is essentially enthusiasm, which refers to being taken by a higher power, usually personified by the gods, and in this case, Elijah. So that was, I think, ultimately how he sort of felt about it, at least around that time that he was, you know, he believed that Elijah like had would sort of come back sort of again and again in contact with humanity and try to, transmit a certain influence through people. And he thought he was one at that time. Okay.
Okay. So, yeah. And Elijah is a prophet.
Yes. Yes.
In the Old Testament.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Okay. So, you know, all of these experiences are pretty wild, right? It's hard. Like, you know, they even go farther out. Some stuff he said he couldn't even, were so like the concepts he would receive were sort of so profound. He couldn't even really hardly get them out onto paper. Pretty wild stuff. Obviously, if this happened to you, it would seem sort of one way. It's another way to sort of talk about it sort of after the fact, secondhand. But clearly he thought he was experiencing something real. And he was also sort of troubled by whether or not some of these experiences were real, right? But one experience in particular added some credence to the supernatural character of these visions, right? And it's one that saved his son's life. So what happened was one day during this time period, he was sitting listening to the Beatles, Strawberry Fields Forever, and this tremendous pink light hit him. And he said all he could see was this like phosphine pink. And then he said the words of the song started to rearrange, and he heard the following. Your eyes are closed to your son's birth defect. Your son is in danger. He has a right inguinal hernia that's popped through the hydrocele and gone into the scrotal sac. You must get him to the doctor immediately. So he was so upset by this that he couldn't, he was sort of beside himself. He ran into his son's room where his wife Tess was there, and said, told her basically what the voice had told him, and said they needed to call and get the doctor over there right now. He was too upset to drive. So they call the doctor, and he comes over and examines the child and says, yeah, like, you know, this is something you can examine by hand, right? You can tell when something has popped through. And he said, yeah, actually, this is, you know, we need to get him into surgery. So the next day he was taken into surgery. And after a successful operation, the surgeon comes out and is like kind of stunned that they knew this, right? And he said, your baby could have died at any time. So,
oh my God.
Yeah.
So and that diagnosis and that terminology, it's right. it's like medical speak.
It's medical. Like the doctor was like, how on earth did you know
like
this?
Like, what are the odds?
And what are the odds? And then also that, like, you know, he said he could have died at any time, right? Like, that's pretty crazy. And so there's no way he could have otherwise known about the state of his son's internal organs, right? So to him, this confirmed the legitimacy of these experiences, at least to some degree, right? Like, right. He's come into contact with not just useful information or spiritual teaching, but literally a scientific, a medical diagnosis that saved his son's life. And so he had many subsequent visions. Again, too many to enumerate here. But he says he owes much to what he called the shiny fire that shot up the walls and around the aperture of the door and zapped him. So he would often see this sort of like pink light, and sometimes he described it as St. Elmo's fire. It was like a light that would sort of like circuit through the room or like catch the room on fire. Or sometimes he said it was like a pink beam of light that would come down into his head, basically.
Pretty awesome.
It does sound pretty awesome.
Well, I have a question. I mean, did he see it like physically, or was this something that was sort of like in his mind's eye? Did he describe it as something where it was like he actually had this physical experience of seeing this light?
Yeah. Definitely. It was definitely like an all-consuming experience. Like he said, sometimes the light was so intense that that's all he could see was this pink light.
By the way, you guys can't see it, but I've got like this light in my room.
Yes, you are glowing in a pink
synchronicity.
Light right now. Totally. So, you know, these experiences had a very profound effect on him, you know, and they, you know, he took them very seriously, you know, especially once he sort of believed that the spirit of Elijah had come to him. Though, you know, this went on for about a year, and then slowly that feeling faded. To the degree that later in 1976, he actually tried to end his own life after he believed the spirit Elijah had left him. So like he felt so sort of like empty after he felt like that influence was no longer working through him that he tried to end his life then. Luckily, or I don't know, for us or for him, whatever, he didn't, though he did continue to write about these experiences for many years.
Wow. Did he discuss how he knew that the spirit had left him?
He said it was a feeling. He just felt like it wasn't there anymore, right? So yeah, he was like, he said he felt this presence with him like all the time during that time. And like I said, like influencing his life, coming through him, he would receive these, like sometimes he was kept up all night receiving, you know, what he sometimes called transmissions, that, you know, he said would he would receive all this sort of information or knowledge of all this different kinds. So yeah, like that eventually stopped, right? Or tapered off to the degree that he didn't feel that presence anymore. And it was very painful for him. So he then spent many years, really the rest of his life, trying to interpret and digest, trying to understand these experiences and what they meant. So he logged and wrote about and commented on many of them in his sort of thoughts about it in a personal and unfinished work that he worked on up until the end of his life. That work was called The Exegesis, which I think I might have already referred to, but exegesis basically means to interpret, and usually in the sense of like a scripture, right? So it was like his attempt to, you know, interpret what he saw as this sort of like divine influence. And he wrote about it, I think like every night in these like late night writing sessions, and he would write by hand, sometimes as many as 150 pages at once, which is just a lot by hand, right? Like,
whoa. So that's yeah. Intense. So like it's be, it like he's intense. Dictating or it's being dictated to him.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely something driving him. I mean, to write like that is pretty wild. So in total, there's about 8,000 pages of notes. Only 1,000 pages of it has ever been really formally published. I think there's different versions of it, but certainly there's not an 8,000 page work that out there. A lot of people have sort of tried to come through it and, you know, like I said, you know, offer edited versions of it. But there's also many other places those visions are captured. Like I said, in some of his work, it was a big theme, Valis, for instance, the biographies of the people around him during that time, such as his wife, Tess. There's many posthumous biographers, and he gave a bunch of interviews as well. So there's quite a few, you know, records of his descriptions of what he went through, including ones that he wrote himself. Yeah, and in fact, R. Crumb actually did a piece in Weirdo number 17 where he tried to capture some of these experiences from the exegesis and interviews he gave called The Religious Experience of Philip K. Dick. So his thoughts on his experience, like I said, he really spent, you know, the rest of his life trying to understand them. And, you know, the theories by himself, by the people around him, and then obviously, you know, after the fact, ranged greatly, right? From mental illnesses like schizophrenia or biological reasons. And this is a weird one, but it I think it's the most current, like currently favored one in the, like, you know, sort of scientific community. They're like, they thought he had epilepsy. And they're like, oh, it's just epilepsy, you know?
Oh, which commonly helps you diagnose your son when there's a medical emergency and you have no idea. Yeah.
There was a lot of, I guess there was a number of visionary like scientists that had it, you know, whatever. We don't really understand these like correlations, but.
But even so, it's kind of like what we've talked about a lot on this show. If the brain is a filter,
right,
and
right,
there's greater right. consciousness at play, and certain things can kind of help
pop it open,
loosen things out. Yeah. Yeah, like just the fact that there's mental illness or epilepsy or some drug-induced state yeah. or a near-death experience right. or dream state or whatever, it doesn't nullify the potential reality of
right, yes. right, right. Yeah, yeah, totally, exactly. You know, he definitely also considered that this was a divine or at least spiritual intervention of some kind. I think one of the biographies I was looking at was actually called Divine Invasion, which I liked. Last but not least, my personal favorite, and I'm to understand from one of those biographies that he may have ultimately concluded this. But again, it's like hard to say. But another interpretation was that the light beam transmissions were extraterrestrial in nature, and that actually came from a race of three-eyed beings that he sort of saw enclosed in these sophisticated communications apparatuses. And so they were like essentially, you know, beaming him these messages from across the galaxy. And so he even drew some pictures of them. They were kind of crude, but definitely post them. He drew some picture of them in his notes in the exegesis. But look, whether, you know, a divine inspiration from an earthly spirit or the transmissions of an evolved celestial race or something we just can't understand, certainly something profound happened to Philip K. Dick, and the meaning of which still pervades and remains a mystery that sort of ever echoes through his timeless stories. And so that is only some of the visions of Philip K. Dick.
Wow. Wow. And I can't wait to watch these films now. It's funny. I never delved into them. And now I can't wait. So I have a question. You read a lot of material and researched a lot for this episode. What's your take on it? And what do you think his take on it, on his experiences were? I mean, you've mentioned alien, you've mentioned divine. Where do you kind of net out?
Oh, man, that's an interesting question. Because I think it's a hard question to answer because, I've said on the show a number of times, like, I think it's like, shit's weirder out there than we could possibly imagine. Do you know what I mean? And like the idea of, you know, a evolved, you know, spiritual alien race out there, and the difference between that and a, you know, sort of divine evolved spirit here on this planet. Like, what's the big difference? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's almost like, do I believe that he, was in contact with something otherworldly? Yeah, definitely. I definitely think he was. I think that, you know, this sort of like, you know, any, you know, these, you know, these experiences definitely happen with people, you know, in hallucinogenic visions and things like that. But like this idea of the light, right, and the fire, is, you know, definitely a mystical, religious symbol, right? The idea of fire and just the idea of this light and being able to see light tracing around doorways and things like that. Like, I'm sure some of our, you know, listeners have probably had experiences like that, but the idea that, you know, something was coming through this that, I think, you know, that was really hard for him to understand and may have like kind of driven him crazy a little bit in his pursuit of understanding it on a intellectual level. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think mm-hmm. that something came through sort of in the spirit of what he wrote and the spirit of his experiences. And I think he was in contact with something. What it was, I don't know. I think, you know, another thing we've talked about on the show is that we tend to sort of clothe, we put form on things that are sort of formless using the sort of like vocabulary of our sort of upbringing and worldview, right? Like, you know, it's, a Christian will have a Christian religious experience. A Muslim will have a Muslim religious experience, right? Like somebody else in a, you know, in the, you know, jungle in Costa Rica might have a totally, you know, doing a ayahuasca or something might have a totally different natural world vernacular sort of experience, right? With spirits and plants and things like that. And so I think that like, what's the most interesting to me is that some sort of door of perception was sort of open for him. And I think that, you know, his son was saved by it in the least, right? And I think that he, I think these things can like sort of work on us in a way that we don't really understand. And that, you know, as we try to understand it intellectually, like sometimes that can lead us away from it and drive us sort of crazy, right? Like, so I think he was sort of plagued by his, you know, sincere desire to interpret and understand what he was going through. So I think it was, you know, and yeah, was there, you know, did he have some, I don't want to say mental illness or whatever, but like, did he have something going on physiologically that might have played a factor in this? I don't know. What does it matter? Right. Like what matters is the sort of contents, you know, like, you know, who cares, you know, if how the apple fell on your head, like, what did you get from it? Right. Like that's the, so I, you know, like, I don't know. Was that, did that kind of answer what you're asking?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, what do you think? What do you think? I mean, I know this is like all new to you.
Well,
but
I think I'm on the same, I'm on the same page with you. I mean, just like listening to this, I mean, the story that obviously sticks out is the one involving his son, where he gets this very specific diagnosis and technical terms that he probably couldn't have come up with himself. It's not like, oh, there's an issue around the heart or, you know, something like that. It was very specific and it ended up being true and saving his son's life. And so he was obviously somehow accessing knowledge that he couldn't have just come by himself.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, like we've talked about on the show, there are, you know, different ways of doing that, whether it's through prayer or meditation or some kind of drug experience or your dream state or astral projection or, you know, mental illness even. You know, it's sort of like that the veil becomes thinner for some people at certain times. And I think to a greater or lesser degree. And I think especially like when we talked about near-death experiences, people, when they're released from their bodies, all of a sudden seem to have access to all kinds of knowledge. So I feel like it's like there's a greater awareness out there and just certain...
There's like a spiritual internet thing.
Yeah, so he's able to tap into it, you know? Right, and I think it's abilities that we all have to some degree. And for whatever reason right now on this plane in our existence, it's not immediately accessible usually, but sometimes it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's fascinating though.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things that stuck out to me with him and then also just in like in terms of like his interpretations of this experience, you know, VALIS, again, stood for Vast Active Living Intelligence System, right? So he believed there was a technological component to this, which I think is very interesting too. So it wasn't like he felt like there was, you know, at least in terms of, I'm not talking about his experiences with Elijah. I mean, his experiences with the transmission of the like pink light. So he felt like it wasn't just some type of like telepathy, but that there was an intermediary of either a artificial intelligence or some type of technological, you know, some type of like apparatus. You know, when had the vision of this, this, you know, race of three-eyed beings that lived, you know, far away, they were all in these complicated apparatuses that let them transmit to him, right? Which I just thought was also super interesting, right? Like just that idea, which, you know, definitely is a theme that comes up when a lot of people try to, talk about or try to understand how, like, UFOs could potentially work. Like Dr. Stephen Greer talks about this a lot, right? Where it's like, he believes that a lot of these UFOs are actually like driven by, operated by, technology that can connect to these beings' consciousness, right? That they're actually operating these things so that they're able to think of a place in the galaxy and go there, right? Based off that thought. And so this idea that there's beings out there reaching out with, you know, not just a crude sort of satellite, but a satellite that's like kind of tapped into their consciousness and they're trying to like reach out. I mean, it's like crazy shit. That's like really interesting, right? Like, isn't that like, it's such fascinating. A cool thought. It's fascinating. And like, these weren't, you know, he is a science fiction writer after all, but these were things that he saw. These were like, for him, these were real. This was real. Like, you know, anybody who's had any type of experience, any sort of vision of any kind, knows that it is real to those who it happens to. So for him, this wasn't something like he's like, ooh, wouldn't that be cool? In his mind, he experienced this firsthand, right? And just that and he's certainly not the only person to have that experience and talk about it. A lot of contactees have like had this type of experience, but there's clearly a spiritual component to this as well. But the transmissions that he talked about, he said were like, it's hard to talk about him here because he said this would happen for days and days and days. And like all night long, he would have these like long drawn out, downloads, if you will, of information. And some of it, like he couldn't even retain. There was so much that would come to him. So yeah, like that idea of this like vast active listening intelligence or whatever. He thought there was some artificial intelligence that was involved here as well.
Wow.
Vast active living intelligence system. So he was like, is it a computer? Is it a consciousness? Is it something that's like both? Wow. Right?
Preceding AI and all the stuff that's going on with that right now too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and he and also back to this idea of the sort of transtemporal constancy, this idea of a sort of living interconnection between time periods, I thought was also very interesting, right? Just this idea that like the past isn't just the past. It's like has a can have a connection between time periods across time, right?
Right.
Like there's some sort of influence of Rome in here. I think, he's written about some like stuff like this, but like just this idea that like, in a lot of ways he felt like Rome was still, that we're still essentially living in Rome. That was his perspective, right? Like that everything mm-hmm. was flowing from Rome to now. And that we were living in just like really just like an extension of that.
Yeah, it's very interesting, and it kind of like gets into like quantum physics.
The
ideas of like, okay, like everything's ongoing and there are all these alternate realities that maybe right. you've lived this other existence, or like when we've talked about hauntings even, and there are certain kinds of hauntings that are sort of like, it's not that ghosts are so boring they have to do the same thing over and over again at the same time every night and they're like zombies.
Right.
It's that it's not a consciousness, it's like an imprint.
It's like an imprint, it's like an echo, but it's an echo that's like getting threaded through a moment, through time, right? So it's not like, the spirit doesn't go into the light and it's there for 100 years from its perspective, it's just been there for like a minute, and then it finally goes in the light. But I think that, or like people that'll see, like, I think about that sometimes with like the Phoenix lights, right? Like people just kept seeing it, over and over again in the same spot at the same time of year. as if it were just threading through over and over again. Like, why would this thing be, it's a year late, it's a one solar revolution on Earth, I got to get back to that same spot. It's like, no, maybe this thing was like literally passing through this particular moment, and it's like repeating. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know. Speaking of Phoenix Lights, it kind of looks like my mic is Phoenix Lights right now.
I know. That's all I can see.
Yeah. It's getting dark here. So yeah, that's Philip K. Dick. So yeah, like, I mean, I would definitely, you know, if anybody hasn't read him, definitely, like, you know, there's some great books to read. Android's Dream of Electric Sheep, that's a great one. You know, Blade Runner is probably, like, just from a movie point of view, you know, probably one of his, one of the better ones that was made from his work. You know, also A Scanner Darkly with Keanu Reeves. I don't know if you remember that coming out. That's another good one. Minority Report. Like, really, you never saw that?
No, I never saw. I know, I'm embarrassed. I think the reason is because they all felt like very much like dude movies, you know?
Yeah, I mean,
and I didn't even delve into it. I didn't realize that this was sort of the territory. Otherwise, I would have done it ages ago. But I don't know. I guess things blowing up.
Well, there's definitely some dude movie aspects to them, like you know, Total Recall. That's probably like one of my favorites. Like, you know, Schwarzenegger, right? Like, but he's got like there's always like a thought behind it that's interesting, and like, you know, this idea of implanting memories, this idea of like these like realities that are created. You know, like, what are the implications of getting inside of people's minds, right? Like, that's kind of what is sort of pervades all of these, like, or, you know, do androids dream of electric sheep, right? Just this idea of like artificial intelligence coming alive, and like, what are the implications of that? And so, yeah, I mean, you can see like in a lot of his work why he was sort of obsessed with these themes is because he was sort of grappling with them in his own life.
Yeah. So. Wow. Well, I'm going to watch, I'll watch Blade Runner tonight.
Okay. Yeah, do it.
You know what I think?
Yeah, for sure. Cool. Well, I guess I feel like we did it.
We did Philip K. Dick. That's awesome. Thank you, Seth.
Yes. Yeah,
this is great. So if any of you guys have any thoughts out there about this topic, if you've got anything else
experiences
to add,
you wanna,
if you've got pink lights and three-eyed beings communicating with you, please let us know. Yes, you can DM pictures. Us. You can follow us on Instagram at Shadowland Podcast, shadowlandpodcast@gmail.com if you want to email us. And I also just want to say, if you want to support the show, leave us a rating or review. We really appreciate it. We read them all. Super helpful. And so thanks for listening.
Oh, and merch. Yeah, we still got some. I always forget to like bring up the merch. We still got some merch out there. So.
We've got some merch left. We've had some orders, and some of the sizes are running low. But we've got t-shirts. We've got long sleeve, short sleeve, several different designs. Seth did an awesome job. Creating those, and then we've also got stickers and buttons too.
Right, we got that too, so check it out. All right then, well, I guess until next time,
talk to you soon.
Talk to you there. Bye.
Shadowland Podcast is produced by Seth Jablon and Christina Callery, edited by Tim Kelly, theme music by Tim Lincoln.
Thanks, Tim.